Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
Are we allowed to say fuck on here?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Thank you, by the way, for saying fuck. Nobody says fuck enough on this podcast yet.
Fuck's a great word.
Welcome to Sound Waves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. This is your host, JP. Slug, an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, is one of the oldest independent publications in the United States, distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and subculture. On today's show, we'll be talking with the band All Pigs Must Die, hearing some new tracks from Danger Hailstorm and the Saint Anne, doing the Daily Calendar weekly rundown with Esther Moronio, and hearing some information about the Book Arts program with David Wolski. We'll also be talking with film critic Jimmy Martin about the summer's flops and successes. Members of the bands The Hope Conspiracy and Converge formed into All Pigs Must Die, and we've got an exclusive interview with Kevin Baker, courtesy Ricky Vigil. Their first full-length album, God is War, is out August 16th via Southern Lord Records. The album cover is of Jesus' head impaled on an inverted cross, if that gives you any idea about their music. Let's listen in as Mr. Vigil gets more information about this new group.
You guys all work full-time, and how does that impact the band, and how does that impact basically making music either in this band or in your other band?
You know, the most important thing is the music,
mm-hmm.
and when it comes to making the music, you know, writing and recording, I mean, we have time to do that. That's the thing we have time for, and that's the most important thing to us as a band, is that we're constantly writing. You know, so, you know, we already have, like, a bunch of songs written for the next release, and that's important to us, you know. And when you're, I guess, a full-time band, which I've been in, and Ben is in with Converge,
mm-hmm.
You're kind of, there's a cycle you kind of get yourself into that you have to be in to, you know, to write, to record, to release, and to tour on that release. At the right time, and, you know, all over the world, wherever it may be, across the country, headline, you know, all this stuff you have to do. And with this band, we didn't want, you know, to put any of that, none of that factored in. We just wanted to play music, write music, play music, and we wanted to do a heavy band, something that was a little bit more bare bone and, you know, than anything we've done, you know, before, and maybe a little bit more of like a metal, like an old school kind of metal.
A few, like in the past few press releases I've read about the new album, and like even on your guys' Facebook page, there's like no mention of Converge or Hope Conspiracy. And I was wondering if that was a conscious thing, if you guys want to kind of keep this separate and draw people in based solely on the music, or if it's just kind of something that just wasn't mentioned.
A lot of the stuff that's coming out now, you know, like I'm looking at right now, I got a postcard from Southern Lord, and the press release, you know, has Verge in there and Hope Conspiracy and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand why, you know, they got to do that, you know, for people that may be into those bands, kind of opening them up to this. But when we first started out, you know, we were doing everything on our own, you know, funding this whole project. And we didn't, you know, think it was important. You know, I still don't think it's important. You know, anyone who knows me, you know, I'm sure they'll find out, you know, this is what I'm in, and they're into the Hope Conspiracy. They'll find out about this, you know, one way or the other. And whether they like it or not, you know, it's up to them. But I personally don't, you know, as far as the music is concerned and the band is concerned and what we set out to do, which is, like I told you before, just to write and record and play whenever we feel like it. We didn't feel it was necessary to pull the whole like members of you know thing, because it's really not what we were looking to. We weren't looking to like have this automatic, you know, group of people. people have interest in us. We wanted it to just be, you know, what it was, and if people picked up on it, they picked up on it. And if they didn't, they didn't.
With Southern Lord and with Ear Split, I mean, there's a lot more attention, a lot more of the kind of PR campaigns that we usually see with lots of bands. And I'm just wondering how the approach to this album has been different than, well, kind of how the reception and how the promotion, I mean, like you said, you weren't doing interviews for the EP.
Yeah, a little bit, because, you know, whereas before, like, there is no concrete release date, there is no, you know, basically it was stuff's ready to be sent off to be manufactured, that's when it goes out, and when it comes back, and when we get it up online and you know, in the hands of the distributor, that's when we do that. And so, you know, there's no set day, it just, like, it just came out, and when we had it, and when it was ready to go out. And with this, seems like there's a lot of, it's out of my hands, it's out of the band's hands. We didn't have the time to deal with anything, you know, as far as, like, what goes into properly releasing an LP. We were fully prepared to put this LP out on our own, like we put out the first record. We were ready to do it, just do it like we did it the first time. And whoever got it, whoever didn't. But Greg over at Southern Lord got in touch with me, you know, by email. He just, like, out of nowhere wrote to me. He got his hands on the EP, and he really liked it, so he just wanted to write. Basically just tell us that. That was it. That was the extent of the conversation, and, you know, just was really kind of blown away by it. Because as far as the label goes, I really respect what they do over there. So anyway, yeah, we kind of just kept in touch. You know, he just wanted to, you know what the band was up to. And I don't even think, you know, we didn't even play a show at that point when he wrote to us. I think we just booked our first couple shows in New York City. And I told him, you know, I was like, hey, you know, we got this record recorded, or we were going in, I think we were going in to record the record at God City right before Christmas. So he just told us to keep in touch, and he wanted to know if we played, and I said we've never played. If we ever do anything, you know, I really got to see you guys play and all that stuff, because I basically told him, you know, if we ever did anything with another label, Southern Lord is probably the only label we would want to work with this band, you know. And so, you know, we played the shows, and you know, I guess he saw, you know, the sets, or word got back to him from friends in New York who went to the show to see us, and you know, and they were great shows, so he was pretty stoked, so he invited us to come down to play the Power of the Rift showcase in South by Southwest in Austin. We said yes, and because we just thought it would be a really good time to go down, you know, hang out with each other, play some new song, you know, play our music, you know, to people, you know, where, you know, people from all over the world would be, you know, in one place for a band that's not full-time and touring. It just seemed like a good idea to get down there and get in front of as many people as possible and just have fun with it. So we did that, and between the time we said yes and getting down to South by Southwest, we, you know, hashed out a record deal with them, and everything up to this point has been awesome. They just really are a good group of people to work with.
For some more detailed information and exposition on that interview, read Ricky's online metal blog posted July 27th, 2011, and go to facebook.com/APMDband for more info about tours and music from All Pigs Must Die. One of my favorite hard rock metal bands ever to come out of Salt Lake City is called Danger Hailstorm, featuring Terrence D.H., the founder, on vocals and guitar, Van Christensen on drums, and Jeff Williams on bass. They formed in 2008, and they've been pumping out albums ever since. Now here's their new single, War. Their new album, War, is going to be released August 23rd. For lyrics and a free download of the song you just heard, visit dangerhailstorm.bandcamp.com. David Wolski is the creative director of the Book Arts program at the U of U. It was established in 1995 to teach students printmaking and letterpress. The U offers classes through the Art and Art History Department in letterpress, bookmaking, and artist books, along with workshops and classes for community members. Ryan Hall interviewed David Wolski for our August 2010 issue. Here's what David had to say.
So, how did you get started with the Book Arts program?
I started here 2.5 years ago. I moved here from Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And what part?
I was living in Logan Square and working as a
freelance graphic designer and teaching letterpress at the Center for Book and Paper. It's at Columbia College.
Oh, wow. And so what brought you out to here to Utah?
I moved out here for this job.
Oh, great.
With this program.
Okay. And then what exactly do you do with the book arts program?
My title is creative director. Mm-hmm. So I handle all of the design, any visual marketing that we need. I am the designer for the Book Arts program and the Red Butte Press, so okay. Any special projects that we do, I will design them, art direct them, handle pre-press, and I also do some of the printing. With the last book that we did, I was one of the assistant printers, and then in addition to my responsibilities as the creative director, I also teach letterpress printing.
Okay. How did you get involved? I guess what drew you to things like letterpress?
My training is as a graphic designer, so I have an undergraduate degree in studio art, and then after working for a couple of years as a web designer, 2000 to 2002, I really felt disconnected from the craft of design and making physical things with my hands, and so I decided to go back to school to get a master's degree, and I went to Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, and they had they still have a really fantastic letterpress facility that belongs to the graphic design area. So from the very first project in graduate school, I started working with the letterpress. Letterpress is there, and they have a pretty good collection of wood type and metal type, and quickly became obsessed, and I started collecting my own equipment and type, and so now I have a pretty sizable collection of wood type and presses.
It's interesting. So you're talking about like the physicality and like the visceral experience of printing itself, but it seems like the whole idea of graphic arts and design is a creative and a cerebral craft.
Sure.
Do you see letterpress as kind of bridging the gap between the two?
I do.
Or I guess not just letterpress, but any sort of like mechanical or physical printmaking?
Yeah, definitely. Because design, you know, one of the dictionary definitions of design is to plan or engineer. Mm-hmm. And if you're working on commercial design projects, there's so much planning that goes into it so that when you do hand off those digital files, the result, if it's a printed piece, commercially printed piece, the result is as close to what you envisioned as possible.
Right.
I think that do-it-yourself ethic that and letterpress and screen printing and printmaking, I get to be the planner and the designer and the artist, the printer. You know, I handle all of it, and I can plan a project out so that it looks exactly the way I see it in my head, or I can approach the press with the mindset of a painter or a sculptor, where I'm creating spontaneously.
Right. So printing itself almost becomes like an experiment.
It is, and that's really where my work in graduate school, where I started to really flourish, is I began to leave behind the need to control every pixel and every point, and let go, and thought of it more as I liken it to music, improvisation, jazz. I'm really responding to each aspect of a print as it's being created. I respond to the color on the paper, the placement on the paper, its relationship to the margins and anything else that is printed. Really think about harmony and point and counterpoint and trying to achieve it's a composition.
Yeah. It's really interesting. That reminds me of, I'm really interested in kind of looking at this whole do-it-yourself ethic that exists in printmaking. It's also with technology. It's really interesting with the proliferation of technology. The DIY movement has affected, you know, music and film.
Yeah.
In a huge way. Now more than ever, filmmakers can go out without any sort of extra funding or producers or anything like that and just shoot a film.
Yeah.
And a lot of really established filmmakers are doing that now with digital technology.
Sure.
Like Steven Soderbergh and people who just go out for like $40,000 and shoot a feature.
Yeah. Same with music.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's really liberating, but at the same time it seems like printmaking is using that do-it-yourself ethic but kind of going backwards and using older technologies to approach printmaking kind of as a more explorative or kind of experimental way of getting of design and craft.
Well, when I was at Indiana University, I was teaching, and one of my mentors there used to say that, and he may have appropriated this from somewhere else, but he would say that technology doesn't die, it becomes art. And that's really, I think that has been a contributing factor to this renaissance of interest in letterpress printing, because letterpress printing for 500 years was the only way that books or ephemera were printed. And it, starting around the 1950s and 60s, when photolithography started to really take over, letterpress equipment started to become readily available to designers and artists. They could get a press for very cheap.
Right.
Printers were often throwing away type because it was taking up space in their shops and they didn't make any money off of it, so it was just junk material to them. So an artist or a designer could get a press and some type, and in their off time they could play and experiment and really explore the kinds of ideas that they don't get paid to,
right,
in their 9-to-5 jobs.
It's really interesting. That reminds me of kind of what's happening in music right now, with how easy it is and how easy it is to record digitally and how kind of good stuff is sounding.
Sure.
Now without trying really hard. A lot of artists, I wouldn't say reverting back, but a lot of sort of my generation are experimenting with technologies that we sort of grew up with, but mm-hmm. not really, such as like recording directly to tape,
mm-hmm.
keeping everything strictly analog.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, because it's super cheap, because, you know, you can buy like a dozen tapes for like $2 or whatever. But also it's this idea that like using the form of like the tape, the really grainy texture, as part of the music. And so I don't know, I think that's really interesting.
Go visit our archives on slugmag.com to find that September 2010 issue online. And for more info on the Book Arts program, go to www.lib.utah.edu/collections/book-arts or email bookartsprogram@utah.edu. Check out their new workshops that are scheduled for September. Every week, we like to do a rundown of our daily calendar, which you can find in the back of every Slug magazine and online under the Daily Calendar section. This week we're sitting with editorial assistant Esther Meroño. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I want to pronounce it correctly. I know. Perfect. I probably slaughtered it before. My apologies, but
no worries.
Now we're making up for it in a public forum. Mm-hmm. Wednesday, August 24th, I'm pretty excited about an event we have coming up at the Urban Lounge. There's going to be a local DJ spinning there, Chase 1-2, and of course there's a killer headliner. Do you want to tell us about that, Esther?
Yeah, at Urban on the 24th, it's Aesop Rock, Kimya Dawson, Rob Sonic, and DJ Big Wiz, along with DJ Chase 1-2, which is a local. Aesop Rock is a hip-hop legend. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard of him. Kimya Dawson and him are actually collaborating right now on an album that's going to be released next year, which is pretty cool. And Kimya is actually the second half of Moldy Peaches, which was made famous by...
Juno,
yes, that pregnant movie.
That pregnant movie, as they call it. That's the industry term for that. And what's going on Thursday, August 25th?
Thursday, there's also another event at Urban Lounge. It seems to be the popular spot this week. And Bass Drum of Death is headlining. We actually have a slug feature in this August issue. Jeanette Moses wrote an awesome piece on them. They're a garage rock band. And Spell Talk, Max Payne, and the Groovies are opening for them. They're two local garage rock bands that are really awesome. Should be a really good show.
And Thursday, August 25th, there's another edition of the Twilight Concert Series. It takes place at Pioneer Park in downtown Salt Lake City. It's free to the public. The doors open at 5 and the music usually goes until 10 p.m. It's going to be another big show, probably this time, though, with some hip-hop artists.
Yeah, Lupe Fiasco is going to headline, and... Big Crit, is that how you say that? Or K-R-I-T?
I don't care either way, actually. I hope somebody does. People come regardless there. It's not necessarily even about the music sometimes. There's a lot of socializing and beer drinking and food eating, yeah. And there's a bunch of handicrafts that people sell down there. So it's a good time regardless, even if you're not a fan of the hip-hoppers and whatnot.
Yeah, it should be a good time.
And for those that like to imbibe, it's the second annual City Weekly Utah Beer Fest. That's on Saturday the 27th, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes. It's at the City and County Building from 1 to 6, and... Because of the change in liquor laws, you actually have to get tokens to purchase your beer. And so you can get $15 tickets before, and that'll give you a commemorative glass, a tasting glass, and 5 beer tickets, and then you can purchase more tickets when you get there. So I suggest that you go get tickets beforehand because they're actually $25 the day of.
And there's also going to be some music and entertainment and other sort of booths that you would usually see associated with different festivals. So if you're not drinking, you can still go down and check out all the stuff that's going on and watch people fall down, I imagine, and vomit.
Yeah, I think the DD ticket is only $5, so you should have a good time.
What a deal.
For just $5 if you're not drinking.
Well, thank you very much, Esther. If you want to check out more of her writing, you can search her name on our website. She's penned many an article, and you have a new feature, I believe... Salty Spokes Rundown, what is it?
Oh, it's actually called Beautiful Godzilla, and it's my bicycle column.
And Salty Spokes is your bike gang.
It's my bike gang.
Your non-violent bike gang, yeah.
Yeah, for the most part, non-violent.
Do you guys rumble every once in a while?
Sometimes, yeah.
Okay. All right, we'll keep that on the download. I don't want to get anybody in trouble.
Yeah.
Tough ladies, check out her column, and thanks again, Esther.
Thanks.
The Saint Anne is a newly formed local experimental and ambient rock band with some roots in Western and shoegaze. It's comprised of members Travis and Tom Bennett being a vocalist, a harmonica player, a percussionist, and a writer here at Slug. Here's a new song from that group called Congratulations.
Tears of blue.
You can search for them on slugmag.com to find a recent review that we posted from their July 4th show, and you can find them on Facebook for more info and show dates. We're sitting here with our resident Slug film critic, Jimmy Martin. How are you doing, Jimmy?
Dandy.
And how long have you been with us? It's been like 3 years or more, right?
Yeah, I think it has been about 3 years now. God, time flies.
It certainly does. And I recently was sitting with you on our way to a fantastic karaoke event. I don't know if you remember that. And I asked you a question about your origins here at the magazine. And I found out some interesting things. You mind recapping that briefly, how you got involved with us?
Somebody left, and I was actually on the way to go buy tickets for Sundance. And then a mutual friend of Slug's and one of my good friends, Mr. Ryan Powers, called me up and said, hey, I think I can get you a press badge. And I said, and drove to his apartment. Mm. That's my car sound. Sorry that we're listening to it. This is all audio, right?
Can we add a car sound in later? Yeah.
No, mine's good enough. Stop.
Okay.
About 20 minutes later, I'm on the phone with Miss Angela Brown, and 30, 40 minutes after that, I'm up in Park City with a press badge around my neck and thrown into the deep end of Park City and its film festival. It was all glorious since then.
It's been magic ever since.
Magic!
And you have a background in film. You studied at Westminster and the University of Utah, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I did my two undergrads at the University of Utah and master's at Westminster.
So you're papered then?
Papered, credentialed, great. They hang on my wall. Like a dentist's office.
I've seen them. They're real. They exist. It's been quite a summer for movies, if I do say so myself. I've had a great time going to all the comic book movies and the action movies, and even some comedies as well. What have been some of your standouts in the comedy field?
It started out fantastic this summer, and the one movie that I was really, dreading to go see and then walked out with my jaw on the floor was Bridesmaids. Because I thought it was going to be the female version of The Hangover, and I was like, I don't care. And I thought it was going to be a Sex and the City remake, and no, they actually did really well. Kristen Wiig knows exactly how to do a comedy, and my co-host of the TV show Big Movie Mouth Off, Jeff Feiss, actually called it. He said if they are going to make a Sex and the City 3, which, Jesus, they probably are, that she should write it. And so, because it would be good. So that was, comedy-wise, that's the biggest one. And then this, you know, that was kind of the smaller one, and then Thor came out, you know, kind of getting away.
That's a comedy to you?
Yeah, there's actually really funny moments in Thor.
There were.
They did a good job with that one. But yeah, I think comedy-wise, it was Bridesmaids. So. Mm-hmm.
And what about the sci-fi kind of comic book genre?
Going back, I mean, it started off great with Thor, and then one of the bigger surprises, I think, comic book-wise, was X-Men First Class. That was the one that their marketing campaign was probably the most destructive towards that its own title I could ever imagine. They apologized for so many things. The posters sucked. The commercials sucked. And then it came out, and it was amazing. It was really good. And then
one of my favorite X-Men movies.
I think it's up there with X2. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think it's... But then Green Lantern came out and shit on everything.
Oh, man.
Thanks a lot, Green Lantern.
CGI was way too comic booky.
No, it just was stupid. I'm sorry. Like, I don't need a Hot Wheel action sequence with a helicopter. Like, Jesus. And it was because they were selling a Hot Wheel action set in Toys R Us. That's the whole reason.
That makes sense.
Mattel stepped in and said, you have to do this. And that's where you start losing it with movies nowadays. There's too many fucking cooks in the kitchen.
What about Planet of the Apes? That just came out. I just saw it.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's the best movie of the summer. Absolutely the best movie of the summer.
It's up there for sure.
No, I just saw it and didn't expect much from a Planet of the Apes movie, but, you know, James Franco, what I love about James Franco is that he can play the biggest stoner, because I swear to God, he's probably a stoner in real life.
He is, actually.
But he can do these dramatic roles, and, like, you know, he just came off 127 Hours that he was nominated for, and then he actually gives a really great performance in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, but the one who nails it is Andy Serkis, who's the motion capture genius of, I think of the entire industry. You know, he was Gollum in Lord of the Rings, and
he's working on The Hobbit now.
Yeah, Hobbit now. He's actually doing not only motion capture on it, but he's doing second unit directing on it.
Yeah, I heard he was a director.
Yeah, and he's definitely picked up traits from Peter Jackson and you know, others that he's worked with. This role that he plays as Caesar is, he's got to be getting, I don't know what you nominate that kind of, I mean, it could be best acting, who knows, but the progression of this technology has, there was always something about, like, they were dead behind the eyes. I'm like, you know, look at Robert Zemeckis, you know, on his like Polar Express and all those movies. It just never seemed lifelike. But now the technology's there, and those monkeys have the shiftiest eyes I've ever seen, and it's just creepy as hell.
They really did. And the battle scenes in San Francisco are pretty awesome, to say the least.
That's what, yeah, I mean, the first hour of this movie is if there's another movie that's kind of similar to it, it's out now, a documentary called Project Mim, which was about a group of college kids and a professor in the 70s raising a chimp to be a human, you know, raising him with human qualities.
With negative results, ultimately.
Well, the negativity more came from the people involved. I mean, you shouldn't breastfeed a chimp.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah. Dead serious.
I want to see that movie now.
Creepy as hell. But the first hour of Rise of the Planet of the Apes is kind of like this, minus the breastfeeding.
The possibility for future sequels, and it is
they
a reboot.
Need to make the sequels.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Well, they will. The movie's made a lot of money, I imagine, right? Well, you know, the box office over the weekend, was it big?
I want to say like $54 million.
Wow, that's a good opening.
Not too bad for a Planet of the Apes movie, that's for sure.
Indeed. Better than the Mark Wahlberg one, if I do say so, and I'm a fan of the whole Planet of the Apes canon.
I don't have the problem most people do with the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes. I mean, it's nowhere near as good as this one, but.
Well, I didn't think it was
some
terrible.
Some people just pan that thing.
But this one was far better, I think. Although I like Tim Roth's performance in that last
Tim Roth, you like Tim Roth?
Yeah, he was great. As the general. Well, we mentioned briefly that you have a TV show, or you did rather. Let's talk in just a few about the upcoming summer movies. But first, let's get to that TV show of yours. It's called Big Movie Mouth Off.
Big Movie Mouth Off.
And it's co-hosted by MSNs and in this week's Jeff Vice, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Former Slug alum.
His first review for Slug was Jungle Fever.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's some history right there. And he's a great writer, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, MSN's not a shabby publication by any
means. Nah, you know, them old MSN people. They don't know much, right? Of course they do.
But you guys, combining your different strengths as reviewers and fans of movies and divergent things, makes for a good show. You actually met both while working on The Geek Show.
Yeah.
The Kerry Jackson project.
Yeah, that little thing over there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we went on there, and then but basically Vice and I used to get into arguments. I will not say whether or not they were intoxicated arguments, but they were, and someone actually said, why aren't we filming this? And so that's where it came through. And for Salt Lake, there's not really any film review shows out there, like television wise Vice likes to use the phrase of celebrity hand job shows that are out there right now.
As you mentioned in this month's
in
issue,
this month's slug.
Our August slug, it's a great write-up. It's called Big Movie Birthday 1 Year with Jeff and Jimmy on page 8. A really solid, solid piece here. But now you guys are on Xfinity with a weekly movie wrap-up show.
Yeah, every week on channels. Well, on their on-demand system, you can catch us in at any time you want. And then on every night on channel 6 on Xfinity.
And of course, we encourage people to go click like on your Facebook page.
Oh, we love that.
There's already like 6,000 likes. It's huge, but you guys probably want to see 10,000 at this point, right?
Of course. It's never going to end.
Bigger the better.
Why not?
So that's a little rundown on Big Movie Mouth Off. Let's talk about some of the movies you didn't like this summer at the Megaplexes.
Well, we mentioned Green Lantern. This, like I said earlier, this summer started out so great, and it's actually coming back after Captain America was fantastic, in my opinion, and Rise of Planet of the Apes did good, but there was this like little middle of the sandwich fart in there, and it was Green Lantern started it, and which I didn't have a lot of hope for, just based on the trailers, but the one that kind of hit me in the gut was Cars 2 from Pixar, because I love Pixar. I think Pixar is one of the greatest, you know, creations in the film industry in forever, because pretty much everything they touch turns to gold. I think WALL-E is probably one of the greatest movies in the past 15, 20 years. When they announced they were doing Cars 2, I was like, shit, because of all the movies that they've done, Cars was okay, but it wasn't one of my favorites, but it certainly was not the one I think deserved a sequel. And sure enough, that thing just sucked so bad. Now, we say, you know, a lot of us have the argument if another studio did that, it would have been regarded better, but we expect nothing but gold from Pixar, and they let us down horribly.
I only saw previews for it, but I heard Larry the Cable Guy's voice.
He's the main character.
Oh my gosh.
I thought Larry the Cable Guy died like 5 years ago.
Well, he should
have. Maybe I just dreamed that and wanted it to happen. But yeah, I mean, like, I just can't imagine, you know, Pixar is one of the most innovative, you know, studios around, and who the hell sat at the table and said, Larry the Cable Guy is who we want for this picture?
All right, and coming up, we've got quite a finish to the summer, I think, with some movies that are coming out.
There's some good ones coming out. I think Rise is probably going to be like the last one I can't say it's the one I'll love. It's just, that was probably the biggest surprise in a long time, but there's some good ones coming out. There's actually a Sundance movie coming out. When I saw it, it was called My Idiot Brother, but now they're calling it Our Idiot Brother, because I guess there's more than one sister in this thing, but it's got Paul Rudd. Really, really funny. Probably one of the best uses of the word fuck I've seen in a movie in a long time.
He uses that.
It's the way he delivers it. I don't even want to like ruin it, but it's...
Please
it's,
don't.
He's basically talking to a probation officer, and he admits to smoking weed with his neighbor, and then he uses the good old fuck word.
And that's coming out August 26th.
Yeah, coming out then. And then there's some other ones coming out. There's Don't Be Afraid of the Dark is a new director, but it's produced by Guillermo del Toro. But it's a horror flick with Katie Holmes and Guy Pearce. And it looks like they're kind of going back to the old school days of horror films, not this Paranormal Activity bullshit that keeps just spewing out, which I just saw the trailer for the third one. And
third one?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
It's only getting worse. But they make money, so stop fucking seeing it, you know? Like, I understand why they're making them, but...
Well, the proletariat votes with their pocketbook, right?
Well, no, I mean, because those movies cost absolutely nothing to make. You hire a cast of nobodies and film with a handy cam, and you make... you know, $60-70 million in your first weekend. So I understand why you're doing it, but so do the fans of Paranormal Activity die, and to anybody else, don't go see it.
But with Guillermo del Toro, we're going to expect something a little bit different in the film.
And you always can expect something different from Guillermo del Toro. I mean, the guy's a fucking visionary. Like, I mean, he took movies like the Hellboy franchise and made them absolutely amazing. So, but yeah, that one's coming out. And then, some other ones, Colombiana is coming out. It's actually produced by Luc Besson, who's one of my favorite directors of all time. He directed a movie called The Professional, Leon. Ooh, I should plug our anniversary show.
And when is that taking place?
That's on September 4th. For the Big Movie Mouth Off, for our one-year anniversary, we're having an anniversary show at Broovies, and we're going to screen The Professional, Leon, which is one of my favorites, and then Vice chose Hot Fuzz. So come down to Broovies.
I was right. I guessed on your Facebook page.
That it was mine?
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I love The Professional.
I love that movie. And, of course, the beginning of a great career.
Natalie Portman?
Natalie Portman.
What's funny is when I saw that movie, I thought she was hot. And everybody thinks that's creepy. But I'm like, no, I was the same age.
I was young, too.
Yeah, it's not creepy. Now, if I watch it now and say she's hot there, then it's going to be a little creepy.
She had HP, what we call hottie potential.
Hottie potential?
A little better, yeah.
Yeah, well, she's still hot, so she's okay.
Okay.
So, but Colombiana is about a girl whose parents are murdered and when she's a child, and she grows up to be a hit woman, so it's kind of right up Luc Besson's alley, so hopefully we'll get some good things out of that. And Zoe Saldana, who's another hottie. Was it HP? Is that what you said? Hottie potential?
Oh,
but
yeah.
She's already got it, so it's not really potential.
She's got the H then.
She's just the H.
And about your screenings that you do at Broovies, how often do those happen? What do they cost? And is it usually double feature?
Well, the Big Movie Mouth Off one, this is the first one we're doing, and it's in celebration with the one-year anniversary. But if you're talking about the ones that we do on every Sunday night, that's a geek show thing. But still a lot of fun. And it's the last Sunday of every month. They do a geek show podcast. Vice usually chooses the two movies. And apparently he wants to get really back into like the geeky side of movies. We've been doing some more just kind of fun, you know, audience participation kind of things. I think next month, if I remember right, they're going to do the double feature of The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth.
So, I am there.
It's going to be a good one. It's going to be a good
free,
one.
And they're free,
right? Oh, yeah, they're absolutely free. We always say that the movies are free, but the booze and food are not. So,
of course, and tip heartily because...
Yeah, tip your bartenders, man.
Broovies is a really awesome institution, and it's good that it's in Salt Lake.
That's right.
And where can people find out more information about you guys and any upcoming information that we need to be...
If you want to... Basically, the world we've created for Big Movie Mouth Off is our Facebook page, so come on down there. We give free movie passes probably at least 2 to 3 times a week, I'd say. So if you ever... We always say if you join us... and are on the ball and can get movie passes, you'll never have to pay for a movie again. So you can join 5,000 other people.
Well, thank you very much, Jimmy, for
Thanks,
your
man.
Time. Also, check out Jimmy's film reviews in our Slug magazine, and you have a film filmograph? What's it called? Cinemagraph?
The Cinemagraph on the Slug's page.
Slugmag.com.
Yep, slugmag.com.
It's a rundown and a heads up about all the movies coming out.
Well, it's the cool thing. It's something you can pull up like on your iPhone if you're like, hey, let's go see a movie and, you know, let's see which one sucks. And, you know, or which one's great, which one you could do. It's something you can do on the fly. It's not, I think the reviews are only about like 40 words. You know, it's just something to get you in your fast-paced life and, you know, figure out what you want to see. So.
All right. Well, thanks again, Jimmy.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to Sound Waves from the Underground. For more information about the music, interviews, and guests from this episode, visit slugmag.com. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or maybe even angry thoughts about the show, send us an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com, or feel free to call us and leave a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. That's 858-233-9324. That's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and is produced by Gavin Sheehan. Our show's theme and music was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. Our main logo and art design by T. Doan. Technical design by Kate O'Connor, with audio mastering from Andrew Glassett. Special thanks to Adam Sherlock and Eric Tomorrow for their help and support. This has been JP. Thanks for listening to Slug Magazine's Soundwaves from the Underground.